This is Radio Sofia, Bulgaria calling.
This is Moscow.
This is Bucharest calling.
This is Prague, Czechoslovakia.
This is Radio Budapest, Hungary.
Polish Radio, Warsaw.
This is Radio Peking.
This is Radio Havana, Cuba.
This is Moscow.
The slogan of the American atom bomb mongers seems to be, judging by their actions, the world must be destroyed.
You are listening to The Big Lie. This is Phil Clark, Mutual News. Once each week, the Mutual Broadcasting System presents The Big Lie, a monitored report of the week's communist propaganda broadcasts. 24 hours a day, The Big Lie shrills forth from 87 powerful shortwave transmitters in communist or communist-controlled countries. The Big Lie is told and retold in English, in Arabic, in Hindu, in Swahili, all told in 62 languages and dialects. The Big Lie is communism's most cunning weapon in the war for men's minds. It is a weapon that cajoles and corrupts, twists and threatens. Mutual believes that Americans want to hear what the communist enemy is saying, and alongside of this, the truth. This week, Radio Moscow blames former President Harry Truman for starting the nuclear race. And in reply to this communist big lie, you will hear the truth directly from Mr. Truman in his own crackling words. Some communist double talk about those drastic new price rises in Russia, and in reply, the facts about Russia's real economic troubles from Newsweek magazine's Soviet affairs expert Leon Volkov. Finally, a communist soap opera complete with sound effects about those U.S. nuclear tests in the Pacific. Tests the Soviets say deliberately threatened all mankind with annihilation. And in reply to this big lie, the truth from President John F. Kennedy. For years, the Soviets have been telling the world that their communist-controlled system is the best and that the free Western system is doomed to collapse. This week, however, the Kremlin was forced to reveal to the world that the communist economic system is in trouble, deep trouble. The Soviet government overnight ruthlessly decreed drastic increases in the prices the Russian people must pay for meat and butter, a 30% increase for meat, 25% for butter. The official reason for the Kremlin's drastic action was that demand was outrunning supply, and in order to increase the production of meat and butter, it would be necessary henceforth to pour more money into the state farms so as to increase their productivity. In simpler terms, the Soviet government was forced to make use of the free world's law of supply and demand, and to provide Soviet peasants with more incentive in the form of higher pay, more and better equipment, improved housing. And the added cost of all this would have to be borne directly by the Russian consumers themselves in the form of drastically increased prices and lowered consumption. For the simple fact was, the Soviet government could not afford to spend more on agriculture without cutting down its huge military expenses, and this the Soviet government had no intention of doing. To the Kremlin, it was bombs before butter, and if the Russian people wanted butter, they would have to pay dearly for it or go without. Here to nail the communist big lie and to reveal the truth behind Russia's drastic price increases, Leon Volkov, contributing editor on Soviet affairs for Newsweek magazine. The Russian-born Mr. Volkov lived under the Soviet system until after the war, when he escaped to a life of freedom in the West. First now to Radio Moscow as it begins its explanation of this week's price rises in Russia.
Anyone with a knowledge of agriculture, and particularly farmers, will understand this latest decision of the Soviet government. The state has increased by an average of 35% the prices at which it purchases the products of cooperative livestock and dairy farming. That means it increases the incomes of collective farmers, makes livestock and dairy farming more profitable, and gives a new incentive for a still more rapid development of this branch of agriculture.
Now for the facts, here's Newsweek's Leon Volkov.
It's true that the raise of prices on meat and butter will encourage the Soviet collective farms to raise their production of meat products. But the Soviet farmers will be disappointed by Khrushchev's backing out on his promise to provide the Soviet agriculture with more state funds for raising agricultural machinery output. Apparently, Khrushchev decided to invest all the funds available to him into military and heavy industries.
Now, Now let's go back to Radio Moscow as it tries to peddle its communist line to the American farmer.
The decision cannot fail to be of interest, for instance, to American farmers. The low prices received by American livestock and dairy farmers for their produce have for some decades been a terrible source of worry to them. President Truman, President Eisenhower, and the present administration all promised to help farmers, but none of them were either able or willing to do this. The sympathies of the government have always been on the side of the monopolies, and these, in purchasing agricultural produce, dictate their own conditions.
That was the big lie. Now let's nail it with the facts. The authoritative McGraw-Hill Encyclopedia of Russia and the Soviet Union states as follows. The U.S. farmer puts in 5 to 16 times less labor than the Russian farmer, yet the American farmer gets 2 times more yield than does the Russian farmer. 25 million Americans now live down on the farm, and their income exceeds $35 billion a year, including more than $1 billion in government support payments. The Russian farmer would be happy with half the prosperity enjoyed by the American farmer. Back now to Radio Moscow as it talks of the happy life under Russia's controlled communist system.
The situation is quite different here in the Soviet Union. The Soviet government is anxious for the farming community to live better and for agriculture to develop. And the Soviet government is in a position to decide such questions. It's in a position to do so because of the socialist system of planned economy. The Soviet government has on many occasions during the last few years carried out measures to improve the conditions of agricultural production. Purchasing prices for various kinds of produce have increased, and there has been a constant improvement in the supply of agricultural machinery. New types of machinery and improved models have become available for field and farm. As a consequence, overall Soviet agricultural production has increased by more than 50% since 1953.
Now for the facts, here again, Newsweek magazine Soviet affairs expert Leon Volkov.
Soviet agricultural output increased since 1953 by 25%, not by 50. The raise of prices will better the life for the farmers, but at the expense of the urban population. The reduction of prices on sugar and textile will make up only a very small percentage of the losses the urban population will suffer from higher prices on meat and butter.
Back now to Radio Moscow for more communist double talk about life down on the Russian state farm.
The Soviet state's task is to bring about a steady rise in living standards for all sections of the Soviet population, both town dwellers and country dwellers.
Here again with the facts, Newsweek's Leon Volkov.
It's true that the state would like to raise the living standards for the Russian people, but the state's bigger concern was and remains its military and industrial might. That was the situation under Stalin, and this situation remains today. The Soviet state is more interested in gaining influence abroad than in providing a happier life for its own people.
Back now to Radio Moscow for some talk about pie in the sky.
What Soviet people are now putting into the development of livestock and dairy farming will be returned to them in the future a hundredfold. As a result of the measures taken by the Soviet government, new resources will be brought to agriculture. This will enable to raise the degree of mechanization as well as the productivity of labor. It will lead to a lowering of the cost price of the produce in question. All this will make it possible in the not distant future to reduce the retail prices on agricultural produce.
Few Russian people will take serious the promise to reduce the prices soon. Without substantial state investments into Soviet agriculture, without serious reforms in the collective system of farming practiced today, there is practically no chance for resolving Russian food problems. And this is the message the Soviet people will get from that decree.
Newsweek Soviet affairs expert Leon Volkov with the truth to Moscow Radio's big lie. You are listening to The Big Lie.
Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. The president challenged us all. Today, during the Freedom Bond Drive for United States Savings Bonds, you can respond to our president's challenge. You can become an investor in freedom by buying extra United States Savings Bonds. Put your dollars to work for America. It's easy to buy United States Savings Bonds through the payroll savings plan. Just tell the bond officer where you work, how much you want to save. Deductions will be made from your pay and used to buy bonds. For just 63 cents a day, you can buy a $25 bond every month. Just think, in 40 months, you'll have bonds worth $1,000 at maturity. And the maturity period for Series E bonds is now only 7 years and 9 months. Start buying bonds this month. Besides building a better future for yourself, you'll be investing in a stronger America. Keep freedom in your future. This message, a public service.
In just a moment, it will be our privilege to introduce on this program Mr. Harry Truman, former President of the United States, who will reply in his own words to Radio Moscow's big lie about the nuclear arms race. The atom bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki has always served as a convenient Soviet propaganda stick with which to belabor the United States. Listen now as Radio Moscow dusts off its old stick and flails away in a new direction.
The slogan of the American atom bomb mongers seems to be, judging by their actions, the world must be destroyed. American governing circles decided to launch a nuclear war as soon as the United States had manufactured the first atom bomb. In August 1945, Harry Truman, who was president at the time, gave the order to explode the atom bomb over Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This was after the rout of Hitler, Germany, and just before Japan capitulated. People are still outraged by that monstrous decision. From a military standpoint, it was unnecessary. Morally, it was inhuman.
That was the big lie. It can be argued, of course, that Hiroshima and Nagasaki were morally inhuman. But how about the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor that started the war? And can anyone say that any war itself is not inhuman, even Russia's war against Hungary? As for the atom bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki being militarily unnecessary, as Radio Moscow claims, the best factual evidence is that many more lives would have been lost should the U.S. have been required to invade the Japanese homeland. But listen now as Radio Moscow attempts to pin the blame for today's nuclear arms race on former President Harry Truman.
This bombing was actually the first round of preparations for nuclear war. In a private conversation, Harry Truman admitted that by destroying Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the United States expected to win the first round in a clash with Soviet Russia. Truman is reported to have been the first to say that it was time to start a nuclear war. In any case, he initiated the nuclear arms race.
That was the big lie. Even before the first nuclear bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, President Truman and other U.S. officials were striving earnestly to create the United Nations so that all wars, nuclear and non-nuclear, might be abolished. And it was under former President Truman that the U.S. took the initiative through the United Nations to bring about a workable system of disarmament, nuclear and non-nuclear. For the past 17 years, these efforts have been thwarted by Soviet Nyets and Soviet vetoes, more than 100 of them. Now, Radio Moscow tries to whip up its lagging campaign of world protest against the U.S. nuclear tests in the Pacific with a communist-style soap opera, complete with sound effects.
On the morning of August 6, 1945, the air alarm sounded in the Japanese city of Hiroshima. A lone American reconnaissance plane flew over and vanished. There was no air raid, so the people came out of their bomb shelters. No one noticed another plane flying over at a great height. No one saw a parachute take off and come lazily floating down. But suddenly, There was no excuse for this atomic murder of civilians, not even the excuse of military expediency, as Japan had practically lost the war by August 1945. The object of that crime was to intimidate the Soviet Union, compel the nations struggling for liberation to drop the fight, and force the whole world under America's heel. That always has been, and still is, the purpose of all American nuclear tests.
And now, to answer this collection of vicious big lies about the atom bombing of Hiroshima and American policy of nuclear arms and peace, Mr. Harry Truman, former President of the United States. Mr. Truman, as we've just heard, Radio Moscow in its latest campaign against U.S. nuclear testing has gone all the way back to 1945 and charged that your order to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki started the nuclear arms race. What do you say about this, Mr. Truman?
The whole thing is just nothing but a big lie. The bombs were dropped after Japan had been warned that we had discovered the greatest explosive in the history of the world, and then we asked them to surrender. They did not do it. We expected to land in Japan with 1 million men. 250,000 of them, it was estimated, would have been killed, and 500,000 of them would have been maimed for life, and that many Japanese would have been hurt. After the Japanese refused, in language that is not diplomatic, that the offer that I made them to surrender with unconditionally, we dropped the bombs and they surrendered in a very short time after that. After that was all over, we had the complete corner on the know-how of atomic energy. I offered the Russians through the United Nations to have the control of all arms under the United Nations with inspection privileges all over the world. The Russians calmly refused. Just a short time ago, less than a year, we made an agreement with Russia to stop atomic explosions. They immediately, within a few months, broke that agreement, and then we had to go ahead and keep on trying to experiment with this tremendous energy to see if we can't put it to peace use. The Russians have always been against any arms control. They've refused every request that's been made of them, and I made as many as 3 or 4, to have the control of all these arms and use atomic energy for peacetime purposes. The only way that we can find out how to use it that way is to continue our experiments. I never was in favor of stopping those experiments, but it was agreed to, and the Russians agreed to it, and they broke that agreement, just as they broke 32 agreements that they made with me at Potsdam and broke 16 agreements that they made with President Roosevelt at Yalta. They are not to be trusted. I wouldn't trust a Russian across the street unless I could see where he was going and had a gun on his back.
Well, Mr. Truman, how would you compare the present ruler of Soviet Russia, Nikita Khrushchev, with the former leader of Russia, Joseph Stalin, whom you dealt with personally?
I don't know Khrushchev, and I don't want to know him, so I can't give you any comment on him. Stalin was a very easy man to agree with. He was not half as hard to agree with as was Churchill. And the reason for that was he didn't expect to keep his agreements, and Churchill did. They're none of them any good. I wouldn't trust them across the trees, as I said a while ago.
Well, Mr. Truman, do you think there's any hope at all for an establishment of mutual confidence in the world today, to the beginnings of disarmament, the beginnings of a treaty to ban these nuclear tests?
I sincerely hope that there is, but the only way that can be done, and done carefully in the way it ought to be done, is to have the power of inspection. Because if you don't have the power of inspection, the Russians will break the agreement. And the efforts on our part has always been to put this immense energy to the use of the free world and the rest of the world, if they've got sense enough to take advantage of it, so that that power can be used for the welfare of the world and not against it. And that's the reason for the experiments. That's the reason we were carrying them on. That's the reason we're carrying them on now. You need to think that the Russians are such angels. They never kept an agreement that has been made with them since World War II, and we saved them. We sent them $6,500,000,000 worth of equipment, which cost them to have enough equipment to come to meet us at Berlin when the Second World War was over. And the only reason that they could get there was because we equipped them. They've never paid back that lend-lease or made any papers on the strength of it. They've been asked to time and again. That's the way they operate. That's the way they work. They don't give a hoot about what happens to the rest of the world if they can control it. which I hope to God they'll never have a chance to do.
You think then, in other words, that peaceful coexistence with the Russians as their system presently set up is impossible?
I certainly do.
Do you think then that we have to wait for the Russian people themselves to regain freedom in Russia before we can deal with the Russian people honestly?
I think when their oppression has become so great, they'll do just what every other nation has done. The Russian people are good people. It's the 300,000 rulers of the Communist Party that cause all the trouble. It's not the Russian people. They're good people.
Thank you, Mr. Truman. From former President Truman, the truth. You are listening to The Big Lie.
Erosion, poor stock, unproductive farming methods. These are major problems in many parts of the world. In Asia, Africa, South America, men are eager to learn new farming techniques and practices. And you can help them through the Peace Corps. The Peace Corps has many opportunities for people with farming experience. You don't need a college education, just farm, 4-H club, or FFA experience. But you do need energy, a desire to help others, a love and interest in working with the soil. The Peace Corps is a great opportunity. You see, you serve overseas, you get 2 years' experience working and helping others in every phase of agriculture. Most of all, it's your chance to make the world a better place in which to live. If you'd like to help your country and the world, write for more information today. The address is Peace Corps, Washington 25, D.C. That's Peace Corps, Washington 25, D.C. This message is brought to you as a public service.
Radio Moscow's last big lie of the week, that the United States has prevented an agreement to ban nuclear tests.
Just when mankind was again beginning to hope, perhaps at the very time when Dean Rusk was again holding forth about the American government's desire for peace. The poisonous mushroom that follows a nuclear blast was rising over Christmas Island in the Pacific. And that was how the United States responded to the world's demand to forego the test.
That was the big lie. On March 2nd of this year, President John F. Kennedy, in a solemn address to the nation and the world, said,
"Every alternative was examined. Every avenue of obtaining Soviet agreement was explored. We were determined not to rush in to imitating their tests, and we were equally determined to do so only what our own security required us to do. For our ultimate objective is not to test for the sake of testing. Our real objective is to make our own tests unnecessary, to prevent others from testing, to prevent the nuclear arms race from mushrooming out of control, to take the first steps towards general and complete disarmament."
From President Kennedy 3 months ago, some facts to remember and keep remembering. You have been listening to The Big Lie, a weekly monitored report of communist propaganda broadcasts around the world. And in reply to each big lie, the truth. This has been a presentation of the Mutual Broadcasting System. Producer, Frank Miller. Your narrator, Phil Clark of Mutual News. We'll be back on Mutual next week with the latest communist line, with more of The Big Lie.